This is an interview September 15th with Charles McGregor Stewart of the end.
Mr. Monroe, but I
Peter Campbell, of the Street Railwaymen. Now, what we want is as much as possible personal histories. Which unions, when you got involved, what executive positions you held, you know, anything of this importance.
Well, how about the little background of what Vancouver was like then, just a few
words. Go ahead.
Well, that was in 1911, there was quite a building boom here. They, of course, it was mostly horse-drawn vehicles at that time. Nearly the most of the people working in Vancouver were either builders or teamsters. And that went on till about 1913. And then there was quite a depression. That was before the 1914 war. From 1914 up to 1916 and 17, you remember, Charlie, there was no conscription.
No.
And the result of that was that there was no jobs. They wanted the, well, the slogan was, "Your king and country needs you, we don't." That's the slogan. So you didn't get a job unless you joined up. So that went on until 16 and 17, when conscription came into effect. There was quite an upsurge in the labor movement against conscription. In fact, the majority of the unions were against it because they believed it wasn't a workers' war, it was a capitalist war. And they made no bones about it either. They came out very plainly and said that they were opposed to it. However, that went on in spite of all these things, in spite of the opposition in Quebec, which was the biggest opposition of all, I think, to conscription. It was put into effect in 1916 and 17. And the strange thing about that was that a week before conscription was put in, well, you couldn't get a job. But after conscription was put in, and a couple of weeks after that, they were looking all over the place for men. It just was a regular boom in jobs. I might say that during this slack period of jobs, there were thousands left. British Columbia and went to the States. That was during the war. And you could rent houses then. There were so many empty houses, you could rent a house, a good 4 or 5 room house for $4 a month. In fact, they were giving, there were a lot of landlords giving your house for nothing. They look after it. Now, in 1918, we were both working at the Beast, with the Beast Light at the time, and I was getting 27 cents an hour on a 9 and 9.5 hour day. By 1918, there was quite a lot of men taking on the BC Light, about 200, because to fill the gaps of those that were away at the front. And these were all young at that time, and mostly they had worked in jobs where there was a trade union before. So us young fellows, we made up our mind that we were not going to have no 27 cents an hour. We were either going to get twice as much of that or quit. And the result of that was we went to all the meetings and we passed resolutions, and finally we got 54 demands put before the BC elected. There were demands about 3 feet long. And when Mr. Mullen of the BC elected saw these demands, he went purple in the face. He pretty near had an epileptic stroke. And he says to the business agent, he says, "Why?" He says, you might as well take over the BC elected. So the business agent said, "That's fine, Mr. Mullen, but we'll." And we didn't get it. Now, in June of 1918, we went out on strike. And we demanded a 100% increase in wages, time and a half for overtime, Sundays and holidays, and a dollar an hour spread overtime. That means, and an 8-hour day. Oh yes, that was the main thing, 8-hour day. And if it took more than 10 hours to get your 8 hours in, they had to pay you a dollar an hour bonus. Well, that pretty near broke the heart. Anyway, we were out 8 days and we got all the demands, every one of them. And we went back to work.
And they got a 6-cent fare.
And they got a 6-cent, they got a 6-cent fare, excuse the coffin.
So they made more than
Yes. So anyway, we were only back to work a week. By the way, at that time, the electricians were in with us on the agreements. Our agreements were up at the same time. And they got the same thing as far as overtime was concerned as we got. But a week after that, Mr. Mellon decided that he wasn't going to pay that overtime to the electricians. There was too much overtime and he couldn't afford it. So, Morrison, who was the business agent with electricians at the time, he just looked up the telephone and says, "All right," he says, "you've broken that agreement," he says, "so unless you mend it by midnight, there'll be no juice." So I was in a Fairview at the time. I was a motorman at the Fairview, and I was doing my best to get in the barn. I was due in the barn at 12 o'clock, but the old bridge was open, and of course it's very often open these days, and I was held up for 10 minutes, so I was stuck my last trip at Quebec in Maine. And I stayed there all night. All the cars had to, you know, they had to stay with their cars until they got the accelerators going, the steam plant at Pryor, to make enough juice to go to the barn. Finally, that was settled. In about 3 days, we were out again for 3 days on strike. And about a week or 10 days after that, there was a fellow by the name of Ginger Goodwin. I don't know whether you've ever heard of him. Well, he was a great guy. He was a socialist. He was also a first-class trade unionist and organizer. Well, they called him up on the conscription, but he only had one lung. And of course, he was put in Class D. There was no chance of him going to war. But after a few weeks, he was up in, was it up in Tralee, was it, Chairman?
Yes.
Yes, and he organized the miners up there. And as soon as he did that, they called him up again and put him in Class A. So he decided he wasn't going to go. So he went over to Nanaimo among his friends, and he had plenty of friends there, hundreds of the miners, they all stood by Ginger Goodwin. They were looking for Ginger, of course, and they had a special constable by the name of Dan Campbell. And it's too bad that a guy like that would sully the name of Campbell, but anyway. He shot Ginger Goodwin in the back one morning. And that was, the result of that was that all the trade unions in British Columbia decided they would have a 24-hour strike, which we didn't. Well, it just shows you the temper of the rank and file. The executives of these unions didn't even have to call a meeting. All they did was put up a notice. So we pulled our cars into the barn at 12 o'clock, and we had another strike. That was three in just a few weeks, 1918.
And these were the first strikes that they had since the organization was...
Yeah, the first strike they had.
When was the Streetcar Union first organized?
Oh, Division 101. What is it now? It was in the...
It was very early.
It must have been...
When was the amalgamated formed? 1897, was it? And ours was 101, so it must have been one of the first...
In the 1880s. In the 80s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
1887, I believe it was the amalgamate was formed, wasn't it?
It's somewhere around there. I'm not sure the date.
I believe. I wouldn't be sure, though.
Well, now that's 1918. Then there's the 1919, maybe you could carry on from there, Charlie, the Winnipeg strike. Well, and that was another month and 2 days out.
Yes.
1918.
Well, I guess the boys know that there was a strong sentiment in the West for industrial organization, formed industrial organization at that time. And the OBU was formed, and the majority of unions in the West, they favored the OBU and put in the street railroad, though we never went into it. But there was a vote taken and it was strongly in favor of it. A lot of the craft unions also didn't go in because they had, although the rank and file favored it, they had quite a bit to lose. Some of them had small pensions for the men, only pensions that there wasn't these days. And they had life insurance and one thing or other benefits that they felt the new organization could not give them. There's been quite a lot of controversy on the OBU since that time, and I think most of us over the years, even now, believe that the industrial form of organization is the correct form of organization. But what it did cause in British Columbia was a serious split in the labor movement, which lasted for almost 16 years, where the militants were kept out of many of the unions. And I think it was early in the 30s that the Workers' Unity League was formed. And it was formed for the purpose mainly of trying to organize the unorganized, which nothing had been done for many years to do that. And although it was only a small organization numerically with some 40,000 members, they did prove to the working class in Canada that the wages and conditions could be maintained and improved even during a period of crisis. They proved that in the 30s. I believe it was 1935 that the leadership of the Workers' Unity League decided that the time would come to try to unify the trade union movement again, and they proposed that the Workers' Unity League should disband and go into the recognized trade union movement, mostly at the AFL. And there was some of that that came to the Labour Congress at that time too. following that, I think myself that the AFL unions and the trade union movement in this country generally took a big step forward and really went out to try to do some organizing, especially after the OBU was formed inside the American Federation of Labour. And even after it was kicked out, it was still a challenge to the AFL that if they didn't organize the workers, that the OBU would. And there was quite an organizing competition between the two groups. And it was during that period, I think, that it was one of the highlights of the trade union movement in this country. And I think it was in 1938, what year was the OBU expelled from the American Federation of Labor?
I just forget that. It must have been before that, I guess.
No, it was...
1939 was the last World War, wasn't it?
I think we held them here in our Congress, the OBU, for some 2 years after the American Federation of Labor expelled them. And I remember in 1938, even the Congress leadership and the trade union movement was opposed to the expulsion of them. But in 1939, I think it was, and I was standing to be corrected in this.
Convention 39.
The convention that was there in Niagara Falls. They decided in the roll call vote, and there was very few of the unions from Vancouver which hadn't instructed the delegates to vote to keep the OBU in. But this roll call vote, a man had to stand up and be counted. And I remember there's one fellow, he's dead now, Bill Wilson. He came to us that day at the convention when the roll call vote was on. He said, "I'm sorry, Charlie, I kind of threw it." He says, "Because that man, this was Martell, he was the board member for the Carpenters and Joiners. He said he would take my livelihood away from me." And he wasn't the only one. There was many of them doing the same kind of thing. And the roll call was kept fast. It was quite an enlightenment. There was one couple there. A man, he was a delegate from the electrical workers, and his wife was a delegate from the office employees. And he voted for the expulsion in the roll call of the OBU, and his wife voted to keep them in. So it even entered the family, you know, but the majority of the Western delegates anyway who voted for the expulsion of the OBU didn't do it because they wanted to, they did it because they felt they were forced to. Our union, all our delegates voted to keep the OBU in. I remember, although it's not, doesn't help you fellas any at all, but anyone speaking on the roll call would have to go up and give your names in. There was so many wanted to speak for and against it. And there was one fellow, what do you call that, international board member again? The Scotchman, Magnus Sinclair.
Yeah.
Magnus Sinclair was before me, and he wouldn't take the mic. He had a tremendous voice, and he gave the most anti-unity speech in the convention, I think, and I happened to be placed right behind him, and I tried to do the very opposite, you see. So I was sitting beside him that night at the banquet. They had a banquet for all the street railwaymen, and I tried to speak to Magnus two or three times, and he wouldn't answer me at all. So after the banquet was finished, Tom Dunlop and I went up to the Thunder, and here's Magnus sitting, standing beside one of these big ashtrays and smoking a cigar, and I went over to him and I says, you know, Magnus, and he never turned around. I says, a few months ago I attended a banquet in Vancouver, and it was for Mr. Tim Buck. He'd just come out of Kingston. And it was the first time he turned around and gave me a look. And I says, and I went to this banquet, and I saw a minister there. And I said to someone, it was a kind of strange place for a reverend gentleman to be. And he says, oh, don't you know him? And I says, no, I never met him. He says, well, he says, that's the Reverend Riddell. He says, come over and I'll introduce you to him. So Magnus wasn't even interested. He never turned around again. And he told me about working on the street railway in Toronto, and he put himself through university by doing that, and told me about drawing up a transfer. The same transfer we were using at that time was a competition on, and he got the prize, whatever it was, for this transfer. It was the one that was accepted by the transportation company at that time. And he turned around and he says, what do you say that man's name was? I says, Riddell. He says, that wasn't a Riddell. He says, that was Riddell. He says, they all reprobate. And he says, I was his driver.
No.
And he invited us up to his room then, and he bid me get in touch with Riddell when I come back to Vancouver. And they wrote to each other, I suppose, as long as they both lived. But I had heard before that, you see, after the convention, that he was going to dig it up with International about me speaking in unity the way I did and countering him, you know. So nothing happened. But I think that was a big mistake that the AFL made in those expulsions at that time, the same as the expulsions they made in the 20s was a mistake. It hurt the trade union movement. And we can go on to these unions that's outside the organization. They recognized the trade union movement of Canada today, where they should all be in. Personally, I think that the time will come before very long where the rank and file will demand that every bona fide a trade union become part of the Canadian Congress of Labour.
Did you mention the Winnipeg strike in 1919?
No, I didn't. That was something else that we participated in too, but most of the time, I think.
A month?
During that period, a month or 5 weeks or something. That was quite a long spell anyway.
And I'd just like to mention that the telephone guilds, they were organized at the time, and they were the last to go back. They stood it right when the rest decided to go back, they wouldn't go back. And they were out for 3 or 4 days longer. So you got to hand it to the telephone guilds at that time. They were really very militant.
But that was one of the black marks on the strike, too. That the telephone guilds were left in the lurch and yes, the organization was broken.
Yeah.
And the trade union movement could have saved it, but they...
The street women voted against going into the OBU, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
The street railroad were voted against, although they had been a record previously to join the OBU.
Yeah.
But you stayed with the Vancouver Trades and Labour Council, the old one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did the OBU form a council too in Vancouver that would operate, you know?
No, there was no... there was no duplication there that I remember. I mean, they didn't have any labor council.
I can't recall, but I'd be surprised if they didn't have.
When did you first get onto the council as a delegate from the government?
I think the first time we were on Queen to be in 1930, something like that.
So did you get at all involved in the Canadian Labour Party and those earlier experiments?
Our organization was involved and had the continued delegates on the
Chris Angus McGuinness was
yes.
From your organization. Do you remember how much support direct financial support he got in his election campaigns, this type of thing.
From the union?
From the union.
I couldn't see, but I'm sure he got some support because he had certainly support of the organization.
Oh, he did get indirect support, you see, because of the constitution of the AFL. We couldn't use union money directly for any other purpose except it was connection with the Canadian movement. And so that stimulated us quite a bit, but at the same time, we used to have certain of our members go down on payday and have a list and get subscriptions.
That's how they do mostly yet for taking up.
Yeah.
Helping the different organizations.
I know I went down myself one day and I got close to $300 just in the afternoon.
What was this for?
Well, for the political campaigns. Uh-huh.
Bill.
Go ahead. There's a number of things on there. Were you in the Socialist Party?
Yeah, this is the other thing too. We wanted to try and trace the political connections.
Well, I was in the Socialist Party for a period of time.
Were you there during the war?
During the First World War. I was in the States up until 1917, I come back here. And I think it was about 1917 I joined the Socialist Party of Canada.
That's what I meant. But was either of you ever on the executive of the Socialist Party of Canada?
No, I never joined the Socialist Party.
You never did.
I was very much in favor of the Socialist Party, though. I used to attend all the meetings in the old Empress Theatre there, every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And we had, what's his name now? With the slim leg,
Kingsley,
E.T. Kingsley.
He was editor of the Clarion at that time, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he
was. Mm-hmm. And that hall used to be packed every Sunday night.
As a matter of fact, I've met a lot of those people.
Yes. In fact, there were so many meetings in these days, it was very hard to get speaking.
I'm sure I've met about enough many people for a quorum in there.
Still a lot of them are around to attend those meetings.
Yeah. Sometimes with a little agitation and propaganda, but I think the educational campaign was kind of the Socialist Party of Canada. That's still got a telling effect for Western Canada, even though they had British Columbia. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a stronghold of the Socialists, you see. They've always been militant, the people of British Columbia, right from the old days.
Well, what connections were there between the Socialist Party and things like the Canadian Labour Party, which the Trades and Labour Council set up?
Well, of course, the Labour Party, well, that came on later, of course. But these were mostly Socialists in the Labour Party. But I suppose it was for political reasons. I'm not very sure on this. You can stand to be corrected. But I think to myself it was for political reasons that they changed the name to the Labour Party, you see. So that a lot of people would vote for Labour that wouldn't vote for Socialism, you see.
But,
they were quite dogmatic in the old days, you know, the Socialist Party.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you, because some guy called A. Goodwin was turned down for membership in the Socialist Party, and Ginger Goodwin's initial was A.
Yeah.
Alfred, you see. And I'm just trying to find out whether this was the one.
I don't know. He wasn't.
Because that would be, I know a lot of people get turned down for membership.
He was a member in the Socialist Party of Canada. Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, did you stay with the Socialist Party until it went out?
I stayed until after they voted on the day 21 points, the affiliate with the Communist International.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't go out then, it still lived after that. I didn't join the Communist Party then either. But I felt that my personal opinion was that the Socialist Party should have been unanimous in what they did.
Well, how long did the Socialist Party go on for?
I couldn't tell you that, but it went on quite a little time after that. Mm-hmm. This Jack Harrington and...
Well, I think it kept on going until the early 30s when the CCF was born.
I think it did too, yes.
That's when it went, you know, the CCF to go.
But a lot of these old chaps that was in the Socialist Party, they might have been sectarian, but by golly, they were true to their class principles anyway. There was Jack Harrington for one, I don't know whether Jack...
He's still alive.
I believe he's in Australia, isn't he?
No, he's around. We've interviewed him too.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He was a wonderful man, I think, and even after the Socialist Party was finished, and there's lots of Jack's old friends went into the Communist Party. He was never an enemy. He still believed it was their privilege to go the way it helped. He wasn't in our division, we were in Division 101, he was in Division 113 in Westminster. But he must be an old man now. He was older than I was. I know when he was on superannuation before I was.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask you a couple of things. What did your union do politically about socialism? I mean, this morning we talked to a guy from the Western Federation of Miners, and they'd have debates on Sunday in a big meeting. There's debates on. Now, is there anything like that in your union? Any promotion of
our union officially supported the policy of the American Federation of Labor, reward your friends and punish your enemies. That was the official policy, I think.
But how come you were affiliated into the
Labor Party?
Canadian Labor Party?
This was sponsored by the Trades and Labor Congress.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was the 1907 convention, I think, that brought up first the question of the Labour Party, and then it was resurrected again later on.
1921.
But that's still quite a departure from reward your friends.
It is, but at the same time, mind you, the international unions were opposed to the Labour Party, and in the political action like that, they still persisted, but that was the policy, and eventually our organization went out of the Labour Party. I just forget what the trouble was at that time. Do you remember, Pete?
Oh, I don't remember now, but I know it was.
But it was caused mainly by the international unions and their opposition to it.
A big breakup came over the Workers' Party resolution to enfranchise the Orientals. It was 26, 28. The Canadian Labour Party went on record as in favour of enfranchising the Orientals. And a lot of the trade unionists voted to get out. This is one thing I want to ask you about, is your reminiscences on the anti-Oriental campaign, and particularly on the activities of people like Ben Goth. Do you remember much of this?
Well, I can't say much I do, but I remember when I came here, I was just a lad when I came to Vancouver, and I thought it was terrible. I had never seen a Chinese in my life before. And the fights they used to have down Chinatown on Saturday night, I couldn't understand that. I thought it was something awful, you know. But when you go into the history of the labor movement, that the antagonism to the Orientals was generated by the powers that be. It's hard to believe now. You can see the Chinese people living all over town, any part of the city. And when it wasn't that, they were certainly in a ghetto.
Yeah, and Labour believed that they were underbidding them and working for low wages, you see. That was the whole thing.
And even in later years, not so terrible long ago anyway, it was during the 30s I was chairman of the organising committee of the Vancouver Trades and Labour Council. And the board member of the Machinist Union came to us and asked us if the organizing committee could organize the garage workers. So we started to organize them. We organized many Japanese and Chinese. And we held the meeting in a hall down Hastings Street. I forget what hall it was. And he came to the meeting and he said how sorry he was. And he got up and read the obligation of the Constitution. And there was no Orientals allowed in the union. He told us how bad he felt about it. And I don't forget, there was one Chinese lad up there and they said that they are condemned for undercutting the living standards of the Anglo-Saxon people. And now when they organize to try to overcome that, you want to take us in, you know. It was a terrible thing, and that organization didn't amount to anything, although we had the majority of the garage workers organized. And it was years before an attempt was made again to organize them, and after we did organize them that time, the jurisdictional fight came on there, and the Teamsters claimed that they were going to have all the washers and greasers, and the machinists were going to have the rest. So the jurisdictional fight there and the organization didn't amount to anything at all. It was sometime following that before the garage mechanics were organized. But they worked under terrible conditions too, and these big shops at the Vancouver Motors there, they would go down there in the morning, and even to get an hour or two's worth, would stand around there all day for it, or sit around, not with any pay for waiting either, just to be in the job.
Well, now, how about you? Do you have any recollections of that, Mr. Stewart? Mr. Stewart, do you have any recollections of the anti-Oriental campaign?
Yeah. Mr. Monroe. Of what?
Oh, Mr. Monroe, I'm sorry. Do you have any recollections of the anti-Oriental campaigns?
No. I heard about it, but I have no recollections of anything specific about it. I knew about it at the time, but there was nothing that...
It was even worse before we came here, it's what I read about it in the early 1900s, was very bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the most that I can remember of it was even the sentiment of some of the trade unions against the Orientals. But these battles on a Saturday night, that was the main thing I do remember about it.
Well, who would you say organized that?
Oh, That's a pretty hard thing to say now, because people get ideas about things. Now, you take the Negro question in the United States, in the different cities in Mississippi and so on. You can't just tell who organized. It seems to be just a something that everybody thinks is right or wrong, as the case may be. You know, you can't put your finger on it. But I know that the organized labor as a whole, with few exceptions, were very antagonistic to the Chinamen. Yeah. And the reason was, of course, that they figured they were undercutting them in jobs. That was the main reason. Mm.
Well, it seems to me that I've picked up things like they felt the Chinese were dirty, and it was more than that. They also accused them of things like all kinds of things, being dirty, spreading disease,
opium, smoking,
opium, etc., etc.
Immorality with white
immorality.
Girls in restaurants, you know.
How widespread was that kind of stuff? For instance, right now, I'm sure that 75% of the males that you that think they're very liberal on Negroes would say that West Indians are very aggressive with girls, you see, much more so than white males. Now, I would say that's racial prejudice. Now, how widespread was the...
There was kind of racial prejudice, too.
How widespread do you feel these other things, other than just the job factor, were amongst the unionists?
Well, I think the job factor was the main thing. These other things were secondary. They were excuses.
Most of them manufactured excuses.
Yeah. But of course, mind you, if you get any race of people that's oppressed and been oppressed for over a period of generations, they might not live the same as you do. And if we had suffered the same oppression, would we have been any better?
Oh, well, that's quite true, but I'm just trying to find out how widespread were these secondary things in the union. You feel they were widespread? Did your members think that way, or in your union?
I don't know. I think our membership generally, in the past, and even up to the present time, we had a pretty good membership, a pretty good trade union membership. And the action had taken most things yet, I think we're still thinking the same way, quite liberal-minded. Well, you see, our constitution in the AFL, as far as the street railmen were concerned, and I have initiated quite a few members myself, you shall not discriminate against a brother because of race, creed, or nationality.
And that's never been changed.
We've
had two international presidents. The original one, Bill Mahone, he was there over 50 years, I'm sure, as the international president. And he never forgot his early days in organizing the transportation workers. He was a driver of a horse car in Chicago. And he quit the job and went all over the American continent, even came into Canada, came in on boxcars, traveled all over the country that way, no wages. And Bill never forgot that. And even when many of those international officers were getting high wages, Bill was getting $8,000 a year. And I was at the convention in Detroit when the motion from the floor to increase his wages to $10,000 a year, and he opposed it. And he had instilled that principle. And I remember when I was expelled from the Trades Council, I didn't appeal the expulsion, but I stood as a delegate from the organization, and the president, he said, seeing I had been expelled from the council, I couldn't stand as a delegate from the union for the Congress convention. That was in 1941, I think. And I appealed that to an international, and Mahone wrote back and supported my appeal. He said he didn't support my politics, but I had as much rights as any other individual in the organization, and the president was wrong and debarred me from standing. And the election came up, I was allowed to run, and I was elected. Didn't know that Pete went down that time too, the convention of Calgary, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Didn't know whether it would be seated and went down and be seated, and I'm quite sure it was the position that Mahon took at that time. And so far as the economy was concerned, we had the almost full local economy. And he said several times that we could do anything we want to that was in the interest of the membership. And the only time that the International would take action as long as he was president was if there was an appeal from a group that the Constitution had been violated. So we've got no kick with our organization at all. We think it's it was one of the most liberal-minded AFL union that still is.
How radical, if I can use that word, was your own local 101?
Well, they were quite militant. I think that'd be a better word. They were quite militant, very militant. There used to be an old saying in the division that we never won an arbitration or lost a strike. So I think that sums it up. And we generally went up in negotiations. We'd take a strike vote first. And then we'd go up to negotiate. And the business agent or the whoever was in charge of the negotiations, he'd tell the company that that's what we want, and we have a strike vote in our pocket, so figure it out yourself. And then figure it over for a few days, and then generally speaking, we didn't have to go. We had the strength behind us.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Well, I was thinking more in terms of political. The fact being, of course, that McGuinness was one of the early parliamentary radicals, and they all through, I noticed in the minutes that the Street Roadmen were donating money to things like the Mackenzie Papineau Battalion, mm-hmm. and all this, and passing resolutions for the nationalization of all the resources and industries of the country. Was this a pretty left-wing union?
It was. Oh yeah, it was saying it was a good left-wing union. Yeah.
Did you take any political activity except as individuals? Did the union itself?
Well, in what way? You mean, well, now we take May Day parades, for instance. We've taken part in that as a union plenty of times. That's a quite radical thing, you know. What's the difference?
Yeah, we were officially represented in the May Day parades for
several years. I was one of the delegates myself.
I got a kind of disillusioned myself. There was one time, it was during the war years, of course. And we had a business agent, and he participated in the May Day parade. And I would say the only thing he did that for was to get the support of the left wing. Both in our union and other unions, the election was coming up for the secretary for the Trades and Labour Council, and he was elected. And I'm pretty sure that his participation in the May Day parade was just for that purpose. I had a different idea always of media parades before that, but I thought, well, there might be people that could use that. It was Roland Gerben.
Roland Gerben. He's now with the...
He's manager for the building contractors.
Exchange, yeah.
Well...
He's on the opposite side now.
Why do you feel the Jewish local was radical?
Why was it?
Yeah.
Well, one of the main reasons is what Pete said, was that during the years that a great many people came into the street railway from the longshoremen, from different building trades, where they had a fairly good knowledge of the trade union movement and the socialist movement. A few IWWs was in there too. And all these things, associating with the other
young people coming on the job had an effect on them. And they knew that it was the left-wing element in the organization that they got in the conditions that they were working under. They realized that, and that had a great effect. Many fellows that they might not accept your political ideas, they did support you in the trade union.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those fellows, they haven't changed their mind yet, I would say, in politics, they're quite conservative-minded. But they still have a great respect for the left wing that was in the union in those days.
Did you hold any offices in the union other than delegate to the council?
Yes, we were quite ultra-left, not only us, but the majority of the class-conscious workers at that time, and we wouldn't stand for to go to a convention or anything. We gave the delegates that went there hell for not doing what we thought they should do when they went. So it was after one convention that the international board member was there, and he says, every time, he said, I come, he said, I heard those fellows talking the same way. He said, it was a strange thing, I never stand for anything himself. And I think that same night was the nomination speech. And we decided to run, and they run all the time after that. We found that instead of being a official opposition in the union, you could demur by being in the union and trying to give leadership. We found that to be correct. We found we've been very wrong over the years.
What positions did you hold?
Well, I myself held the position of vice president for I don't know many years.
Quite a long time.
A long time, anyway. And then I held the position of acting president, business agent and financial secretary. Long time. So I pretty well was in all the positions over a number of years.
What about you, Mr. Stewart?
I was in the same category. I was business agent for over 3 years. President for a short time before I stood for business agent. Prior to that, we were representing the platform men from the executive.
Quite a few years, too.
Uh-huh.
Were you, you were employed all through the Depression, too, right?
Employed, yes.
How well off were you people that were employed?
Well, I would say we were better off during the Depression years. That's an odd job than everywhere before or since, taking everything into consideration.
That is from the outside, but I know my wife used to say that we were just about as bad as unemployed during the Depression, because we had so many friends of mine who had been here so long, and they were all out of a job. So there's nothing for the wife to make a dinner for 10 or 12, and the Mom and Rose, they call it, was an open house. So the unemployed came there by droves, and we never turned them away. So sometimes we were almost as bad off as unemployed. That's what that
meant. One thing that seems to me in the minutes of the council is that during the 30s, the council got more and more and more conservative.
Well, that happened about the 20s, actually.
Yes, in the late 30s, too.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say if the council as a whole got more conservative, but some of the roadmen began to fear that their control over the workers would be jeopardized, and they put an extra drive on to oppose everything that the left wing would raise, even if it was in the best interests of them and the trade union movement as a whole. I'll tell you one thing, the press gave these fights, it was carried on quite often in trade council, they gave in prominence, but the majority of them didn't really bring to the forefront at all the constructive things that was done in the council. And the best newspaper reporter we had, it was in the council there, was Barry Matron. I think he was for the morning newspaper at that time. Yeah. And these battles between the different groups in the Trades Council was secondary, as Barry Matron was concerned. And the issues that came forward, that was to help Labour generally, these what he concentrated on. And Barry would never, if there was a fight between two factions in the council, he would never put that report in unless he spoke to both sides and showed them what he was going to put in the paper.
How permanently organized was the left-wing caucus in the Trades and Labour Council?
I wouldn't say it was very well organized.
You don't think so?
No, except in ideology, that was all.
Yeah.
But so far as the any structural form for organization, I don't think that existed.
Well, I mean, how regularly did you meet? I mean, was it just every year before elections, or was it...
Before election time, we quite often did have a meeting and who was support.
But not,
and that was quite broad, any meetings that we didn't hold before the election were quite broad.
Mm-hmm.
People like Bill Wilson, and Bill had been a roadman even before that, he was sitting in those caucuses. And nobody could say that he was a left-wing radical, but he was a good, honest trade unionist.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, you see, we began to realize, most of us, that people could think differently politically than what we did and still be doing a good job for their membership. In the early days, we didn't think that. We thought they had to be as politically conscious as we were before they could do a job.
Well, if you go back to the...
How about finishing this off? I'm just trying to find out, what about the right wing? Now, what about the caucus there? Do you know anything about their caucus?
I don't know anything about them. I never even heard of them meeting, but I'm quite sure they did.
Well, they must. obviously.
They had a slate drawn up for every election, and the union and the Trades and Labour Council and all that.
Yeah.
I just want to go back a little bit to the particular political organizations. There was the Federated Labour, the FLP and the ILP and the Christian Socialist Party and various organizations. Now, particularly after the breakup of the Canadian Labour Party, were you supporters of the ILP or any or the FLP? Well, the FLP, I guess.
The Independent Labour Party?
Yeah.
Well, if you ask us, were we supporting that as an organization? Of course, we'd say no. But as individuals, we would support any progressive person that was running that we had thought would get a chance of election. That was our policy. But as a trade union affiliate to the American Federation of Labor, of course, we couldn't do that as an organization.
Did you maintain any sort of close relations with the CCF when it formed?
Well, the CCF manifesto that was drawn up in Regina, it was a very good one. I myself supported that. I think that you would too, Charlie. But since that time, it's been watered down now, so you wouldn't know it was the same manifesto. In other words, the CCF, long before the New Democratic Party got in, they had tried all these years to become respectable, you know. So when you become too respectable, then you don't get the vote of the working class. I think that's the trouble with the majority of the members of the New Democratic Party, too. You see, if there's an old country saying in Scotland, you're neither fish flesh nor good red herring. And I think that sums it up. You've got to be one thing or another before you're going to get support from the party.
Although the establishment of the New Democratic Party, I think, was a big step forward for the Canadian working people.
The establishment of the NDP was?
I think so. Because Canada is a very backward country politically, and they haven't even them to look for themselves as a class yet, and that's something that the NDP yet might help the Canadian workers to do.
Mm-hmm.